Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
Don't touch that dial. You're tuned in to the Dread Podcast Network.
Welcome to Development Hell. For every horror movie that hits VOD, countless others end up DOA. Development Hell is the podcast dedicated to unearthing these cursed horror productions. We're going to find out what went wrong and then decide if these titles still stand a shot at the green light. I am your host, Josh Korngut. I am the managing editor of Dread Central. I am also a filmmaker in Toronto, Canada. This podcast is a proud member of the Dread Podcast Network. Hi, everybody, and welcome back to a brand new episode of Development Hell. We've been laying low for a couple of months, but today we're back, and it's better than ever, because every Tuesday this March, we're going to be celebrating an unmade film by George A. Romero with our new limited series, Romero Unseen. So in the very first episode today, we're going to be unearthing his never-made adaptation of the R.L. Stine Goosebumps book series. While we did eventually get two major releases in theaters based on these books, the Romero version never saw the light of day. Joining me for the Romero Unseen limited audio series here on the Dread Podcast Network is Adam Charles Hart. He is the author of the upcoming book, Raising the Dead, the work of George A. Romero, and it's out March 13th from Oxford University Press. This text is the first scholarly work about Romero's massive archive of unfilmed scripts, and it makes Adam the perfect guest host for this miniseries. Find the link to where you can buy that book in our episode notes. Adam, I'm so thrilled to have you with me today. Can you introduce yourself to the Development Hell and Dread Central audience?
Hey, Josh. Hey, everybody. I'm Adam. I write about horror and other stuff.
We're very excited to check out your book, Raising the Dead, the work of George A. Romero. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
I was lucky enough to be at the University of Pittsburgh when George's archives came. And along with Ben Rubin at the library, I got to dig through the boxes and sort them and catalog them. And I just spent a couple of years completely immersed in George A. Romero. It was so fun. It was so fun. And I started writing, first blog posts and then stuff that was a little more sustained, trying to share all the excitement about what we were finding. Because the thing about George Romero is that he had a pretty damn good career, not just making like a handful of beloved classics that any horror fan, but I feel like increasingly anybody who just kind of like likes movies acknowledges that, you know, Dawn of the Dead or Creepshow and obviously Night of the Living Dead and maybe Day of the Dead and maybe Martin. I don't know. If you're a weirdo like me, Knight Riders. They're masterpieces that they're wonderful. It's becoming much more, a widely held sort of mainstream opinion, I feel like. But he also, like, you know, he's pretty productive. Like, he made more features than a lot of directors got to. But the thing is that that's a small portion of the actual, like, creative output during his life. From the very beginning of his career, like, just after he dropped out of college, he was working on movies, writing scripts, developing stuff, coming up with new ideas. And there are literally hundreds of drafts of scripts and treatments and fragments in that archive that never made it all the way through to production. You know, representing dozens and dozens of projects. It's some of his best writing, like just really brilliant ideas. And he's a really good writer. You know, he's very like kind of, hey, get a load of this, like conversational. And it's just like, it's very engaging. It's very fun. He clearly enjoyed writing and he just did it constantly. Like, there are some periods in his career when he was writing like 5-6 scripts, like in a year, sometimes working on multiple scripts at the same time. And yeah, so the book is an attempt to kind of reckon with all of that, like both to share what's so exciting about it, but also to look at this new picture that's emerging of George Romero in that archive, which is somebody whose interests were really broad and diverse. It wasn't just horror movies that he was writing. It was a lot of other stuff. But you also get to see kind of like what a film artist's career is like, you know, because he kind of got tethered to the horror film as a genre really quickly. He got to make a couple of films outside of it, but everything else that he could like ever get produced was a horror film, and a good chunk of those were zombie movies with dead in the title, you know? But you see in that archive, not just this like huge range of interests and obsessions and all that, but you see his negotiations with what the actual career of producing and directing films was like for him, because you see these interests show up in weird and interesting ways in zombie movies, and you start to realize like, oh, okay, so if he can only make a horror movie, then he's going to like inject it with these ideas from like this sort of a script or this sort of a script. And like he sort of realizes really quick, like, well, if I make it a zombie movie and put dead in the title, like I can make a satire that's also kind of slapstick at times, and it's also an action movie. Or like, if I want to do like a talky indie drama about a weirdo, like if I make him a vampire, then, you know, maybe somebody will show up to it. You sort of see this negotiation, this, you know, engagement between George and the industry and what he's allowed to do. That's really fascinating to me.
Would you say that he kind of used the genre as a Trojan horse to sort of get sort of his broader ideas into film?
Oh yeah, 100%.
Very cool. I mean,
but I would also say like that's what makes him such a great horror filmmaker, because like he could have had like a pretty good career just making Night of the Living Dead over and over again, but you know, when he finally makes Dawn of the Dead, it's something completely different. It has almost nothing in common, like tonally, stylistically, or, you know, it is structurally, like anything with Night of the Living Dead. And that's why he's so great for the genre, so great as a filmmaker, because he was kind of reinventing a horror every time that he went out. You know, he was reforming it, reshaping it, to make it something new. And every time that he did that, you know, there was a lot of movies of his that didn't really land with audiences. But every time that he did that, it kind of spawned its own subgenre that had people copying it for decades.
Now, before we dig into our first episode today, which is Goosebumps, where did you sort of begin your relationship with the films of Romero? What was like the first ones that you encountered and the first ones that really left an impression on you?
So I remember watching Night of the Living Dead for the first time. I had found used a copy on VHS. This was in the DVD era, but everybody still had VCRs because I was in college and we were really broke. So I found just like for a couple of bucks, like one of a million different VHS copies that you could find of Night of the Living Dead. And watched it with a bunch of friends who were treating it like this cheesy old monster movie. And I guess there was something like I probably was putting it on with some expectations of that. Mm-hmm. But I just remember watching it and getting more and more into the movie and into like, you know, like, wow, this is really like ambitious stylistically. And there's a lot going on here. Like, this is really smart. And just getting like increasingly irritated with my friends who were like laughing at it and mocking. I was like, what do you make? No, this is, come on guys. I'm trying to watch this. This is really good. And yeah, that's the first memory that I have of Night of the Living Dead. Or like kind of knowing who George Romero was. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I feel like that's pretty indicative of who George was, like his you know, sort of career in a nutshell, like everybody sort of dismissing Night of the Living Dead as this like cheap little horror movie,
yeah,
but starting to come around eventually, like, oh, this is actually really good, isn't it?
Well, people love to sort of write off horror whenever they can, and I do remember growing up and Night of the Living Dead, sort of the image of it was, you know, like there was always someone watching it in a horror movie, or it was always kind of on TV in the background making people squeal. And it kind of just felt like this exploitation movie. And it wasn't until I was older that I realized that it was saying something really interesting and had all these different levels to it. Would it be okay with you if I sort of share my first major introduction to Romero?
Oh, yeah, of course.
I've always been a massive Stephen King fan ever since I was little. And I watched Creepshow very young. I think it might have been one of the first horror movies I watched. And specifically the Father's Day segment has just been so influential to me as a horror fan and like really shaped a lot of what I'm looking for in horror. And I don't know. I feel like we see it as a Stephen King movie, but it's so Romero and it has so much charm, and it's really scary, and it's always been my pinpoint for Romero going forward.
It's my first place in Pittsburgh was about a block and a half from one of the houses in Creepshow, and I don't know that anybody else that I was friends with was like as impressed with that as I was, but
I'm impressed.
Anytime that people would come to visit or something, I'd always like take them and be like, so remember that scene in Creepshow when they're having the party outside and, you know, and
that's so cool.
Hal Holbrook shoots his wife. That happened right there.
Hell yeah.
Great. That's great, Adam. Sure.
I care. And I also care about Creepshow 2. People tend to write it off, but The Raft, how good is that?
I mean, The Raft is great. It's an uneven movie.
Oh, but, yeah, the other two are terrible, but The Raft is so good.
Yeah.
And it's enough. It's truly enough for it to earn its keep, I think, that movie.
Romero was always like weirdly obsessed with anthologies. Like that was that was the first project he ever like got into production. He was like still kind of sort of going to college, and he and his friends made this anthology film that it was almost like 3 hours long, I think, and they shot it entirely silently because that's, you know, it was 16 millimeter and that was just sort of the technology and the budget level that they had.
But it
like never occurred to him, and I talked to like Russ Streiner and other folks who are around Romero in the 60s, Like, so why didn't you just like make a short film and like submit it to like some film societies, or even just like put on a screening in Pittsburgh or whatever? Yeah. And they're like, oh, we didn't know that was a thing. We'd never heard of a film festival. We didn't know that you could show short films anywhere. So instead, make an anthology.
It was all impulse. They just knew they wanted to make movies, so they just like went with it. I think that's beautiful. He's known for doing these really extreme horror films. I think that's sort of how we remember him, very like adult horror. But it seems like he really like had a passion for YA horror, or at least really wanted to explore it. And I think that's why I really would have loved to see what he could have done with Goosebumps. Would it be okay with you if we sort of jump into the world of Goosebumps and sort of what it is and what it means to us?
Yeah, of course.
If it's okay with you, maybe I'll just give a quick sort of seminar on what it was. I'm sure everyone knows, but for people who've been living under a rock, Goosebumps was a horror novel series by R.L. Stein, and it was often for preteens or teens that would find themselves in horrific situations. And it was schlocky and cheesy and kind of scary, like in a way that some kids' content hadn't been up until that point. I believe it was published the original run was between 92 and 97. And it was big for me. The TV show was a big part of my upbringing, but the books too were like a big part of my horror journey. What was your impression with Goosebumps? Where were you as a horror fan when this was hitting the zeitgeist?
So I'm just like a couple years too old for Goosebumps. Like it was very much written for like an elementary school.
Yes.
Maybe junior high. But I'm pretty sure that any junior high kids who would be reading it would be
like, what is this? Yeah.
Or they were like big fans who had been reading it for a few years and were like, yeah, of course I'm going to read the next one, you know?
Yeah.
But I do remember it being like, it's hard to imagine, like to really put yourself back into it at like what it was like at the time, but it was huge.
Oh,
it was gigantic. Like there's a reason why it keeps getting revived for movies and TV shows and, you know, just series. Like.
Yeah. They're still publishing them.
Are they?
There was a new one published this year already.
Yeah. Well, it's just sort of it's perfect as entry level horror because, like you say, it is scarier than most. Pretty much anything that would be geared at that audience.
For kids, yeah.
But it's also not going to, it's not adult horror that's going to like traumatize them for life.
No.
You know, like it's perfectly pitched for the 9-year-old.
It's very pre-Stephen King. Like I think the joke is like you go from Goosebumps to Stephen King. Like it's kind of like.
Oh, yeah. Right. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
You like graduate to Stephen King when you're ready for. Like maybe it doesn't end with everybody happy playing with their dogs and monsters defeated.
And Stephen King's a big leap. Honestly, we were all reading Stephen King way too young and it shows. were you sort of more involved with like the earlier YA horror, like the work like Fear Street or even Christopher Pike? Was that in your realm?
So I didn't really discover horror novels, even like YA or otherwise, for a little while.
Mm-hmm.
Really didn't start reading till I was an adult. But I do remember there was a predecessor of the Goosebumps TV series that was similarly an ultra low budget Canadian production called Are You Afraid of the Dark?
Oh, yes.
And I remember watching those, and I'm sure there was other stuff like that, you know, horror aimed at kids.
Are you just like scary? Scarier, for sure.
I would watch it as a challenge to myself.
Hell yeah. Be
like, I'd work my way up to it, and I don't remember what night, maybe it was on a Friday night or something like that. And I'd be like, okay, Adam, we can do this tonight. we can do this. We can watch Are You Afraid of the Dark? And we won't be afraid of the dark.
Yeah, you will be. It was mean. You were just saying, like, you were ready to move on from Goosebumps when it was okay for, like, the ending not to be happy or, like, everyone not to make it out alive. And that would happen on Are You Afraid of the Dark? And it would never happen on Goosebumps. And as a Canadian millennial, like, it is a very precious cargo to me, Are You Afraid of the Dark? We actually did an episode of this podcast. They were going to make a movie with Gary Dauberman. Writing, maybe even directing. So he's the guy that did a couple of the Annabelle films and is doing the new Salem's Lot.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So, and that never actually happened, although they're making, obviously, or they have made updated TV versions, like they have done with Goosebumps too. Have you seen the new Goosebumps at all?
I saw it. I've loved it.
You loved it? Yeah. I had a hard time with it. I only saw the first two episodes and I should try again, but I felt so, betrayed by the fact that it's not anthology. I really want it to be anthology, and they did it with Are You Afraid of the Dark too, where it's narrative instead, and I'm just kind of pissed.
I just wonder if among the audience, the reaction to the new TV show can be split along the lines of, like, would you feel a betrayal if this was not faithful to the spirit of the original Y/N? And because I never had that much of a relationship with the original, I was just fine, you know, with whatever. I thought it was pretty great, actually.
It is, like, and people, like, horror fans, like, embraced it, and they, like, seem to have done something right. But I like to gatekeep my 90s, so that's what I did with it. And I don't know if I'm gonna get around to it again. I was more upset with the Are You Afraid of the Dark reboots.
Yeah,
you know, they went the American Horror Story route where they do, like, season long anthology rather than episode anthology, and that just must be what makes money now. But it pisses me off. I love a standalone, like, Tales from the Crypt episode.
Yeah, it's very expensive to do, though. Which is funny because they used to be able to do it, but I think that now the expectation for productions is that they can't look like they were just, you know, shot at an elementary school in rural Canada.
Yeah.
And then
I wish they would, but right. I guess because, yeah, that you need a new casts for every episode, and you can't just, like, film it all in 3 weeks.
Yeah. And I don't know, maybe TV would be better if it allowed more just, like, shitty, no production value anthologies back into our lives, you know?
I mean, that's what I'm looking for, but, you know, nobody cares what I want.
I say this with love, but also meaning just, you know, doesn't have to look perfect. The actors don't all have to hide their Canadian accents.
We tried. It didn't work. Just like in My Bloody Valentine, I rewatched it not long ago, and, like, those Canadians were real Canadian in that one. And
pretty great, yeah. Oh,
yeah. I love it. We've given horror so much, and I just don't feel like we're given our due for that.
I had a line in my dissertation. I think it ended up being a footnote, but I was so proud of myself for the line, you can't write about the history of modern horror without at least taking note of Canadian tax policy.
Oh, yeah. That's real. Oh, that's so real and so beautiful. And it kind of still is like that to some degree.
Yeah.
But, you know, getting back to Goosebumps, it was, you were saying earlier, maybe off mic, that it was a little bit like, it happened sort of when you were a little too old, and it was kind of, like, too cool for school for it. But, like, it was perfect timing for me. And there was a few books / episodes that really, like, stood out. And, god damn it, I should have done my research ahead of time. But there was one about a little ghost boy who died in his house because he was a little shit. And he had, like, a dumbwaiter, and he was always, like, demanding his ice cream, and one day he, like, was ringing the bell over and over again, and he, like, fell down the dumbwaiter and, like, now he's haunting the house. And I just like fucking loved that one as like a little chubby kid who also wanted ice cream. But as someone who's sort of maybe a little bit more on the outside, like what books or episodes of the TV show do you think really infiltrated the zeitgeist?
Well, there's Slappy the Ventriloquist Dummy is the one that they have to keep bringing back. You know, you can't do anything without that. But I think more than any specific story, Goosebumps just sort of, it became this symbol of a kind of horror, mm-hmm. you know, that would be about kids, that would scare kids, but that they could handle. And I feel like just that tone was really unique, and it feels like anytime somebody has tried to do that since then, they're just like reaching back to Goosebumps.
Yeah, I do think it was extremely influential, and part of its influence I think had nothing to do with the stories and had all to do with those iconic book covers, the original run by Tim Jacobus or Jacobus. When you like think of the Goosebumps book covers, like which ones come to mind?
Oh, I don't know, man. You're asking the wrong person. Yeah.
I mean, we're going to talk about Welcome to Dead House, which is the first book. And that one has like a really killer cover. And there was the haunted mask with like the little girl holding up the evil mask on her face. And there was the fucking slime one with slime on the stairs. I love these book covers. They really went hard. So yeah. And I think we're actually publishing a video interview with Tim Jacobus on Dread Central this week. And our editor-in-chief like almost passed on it. And I said, no, we have to get this icon on Dread Central. Oh, I don't care if nobody cares. So, yeah.
People care.
They care, but they should care more. You were telling me that, you know, right around the time that Romero attempted to write a version of Goosebumps, this was his 90s. What was going on with George Romero in the 90s?
Okay. So he makes Day of the Dead, comes out in 85. And then after that, he is working with new producers. He's like, his previous three-picture deal that funded Creepshow and Knight Riders 2, that's over. And so after being in the industry for like 20 years, he's kind of starting over, trying to figure out how to get movies made. He gets Monkey Shines off the ground, films that, lot of battles with the production company, not the greatest experience. He does Two Evil Eyes with Dario Argento, another anthology film that like gets made, you know, in part because of Argento, and he does The Dark Half, which is just a cursed production from start to finish, fights, disagreements with the company, which then goes out of business, but also with stars, with, you know, like it just seems like it was a wretchedly unpleasant experience for Romero that was completely unsatisfying, and he never was able to get it to a place where he was satisfied. But like I said, the production company goes out of business.
Who were they?
So it was Orion.
Oh, okay.
It sits on the shelf for 2 years, and then like finally somebody puts it out, and it just sort of fizzles away. Nobody really cares about it, even though it's George Romero and Stephen King. And it's, you know, I see why Romero was dissatisfied with it. Like, he had visions for other stuff, but I still kind of like it. I don't know. That's the last feature that he gets off the ground until the very end of the decade. With Bruiser, which is a super low budget movie that he just kind of like, you know, gets a little bit of money and goes to film in Toronto. This is a very Canada-centric conversation, I guess.
Hell yeah.
But yeah, where he ends up moving and then spends the rest of his career. Although he always like sets it like all the place names. If he doesn't explicitly call it Pittsburgh, he'll like, you know, use place names or street names or whatever from
well,
here.
As a Toronto person myself, I like to think we also claim him to some degree. So Pittsburgh thinks, you know, they have claim to him, but I think Toronto gets some of that.
I think so. I mean, he made for four films there. Yeah, four features he made there and spent a lot, like almost 2 decades living there.
I mean, not to be macabre, but we still have him, I think. So,
yes, well,
which I think is super cool.
And so, I know that he loved Toronto also. I know that he did.
So, yeah, you're saying the 90s was a bit of a purgatory for him. It was kind of the end of an era, and it sounded like it was kind of difficult for him to get things done the way that he wanted. So it was an interesting time for Goosebumps to land on his desk.
Well, so the thing is, like, if you just, like, look at his Wikipedia page, it says The Dark Half, 1993, and maybe you know that he filmed that a couple years earlier, and then Bruiser comes out in 2000, and it looks like he, you know, did nothing or, you know, was just had a bunch of failed projects. And the thing is that he was writing constantly during that time. That was, as a writer, his most productive period. He was just writing a ton of scripts all the time. He was, you know, developing new projects. A lot of stuff was coming close to production, but, like, at that point he wasn't exactly like a hot commodity, you know. Like, his last hit was in the 70s, and it was released unrated, and it was a gross out zombie movie that wasn't the most respectable thing in the world for Hollywood executives. But he had successes, so he could, like, get in the room, and, you know, he was selling scripts and coming close to production. You know, I, as far as I can tell, like, he was making more money off of selling scripts that never got made in the 90s than he was off of, like, making movies in the 70s and 80s.
Sure.
But the thing is that he was working, and he wrote, like, a bunch of amazing scripts. Some of them were, like, developed with a studio, and then he sold it or whatever, and it just never got made. But some, like Goosebumps, were, he just did it on spec, which means that nobody was asking him for it. He didn't have the rights. He was just, like,
oh, really?
Interested in it. Yeah.
There was this, correct me if I'm wrong, but it seemed like in 95, there was a letter between him and the sort of president of Fox Family under the 20th Century umbrella, where I think the producer's name was Kevin Bannerman. Where sort of, I think he was, they were, this is when they were first discussing about the possibility of Romero coming on this project. Are you familiar with that letter? Could you talk a little bit about what's going on there?
Well, I haven't seen the letter. He may have been discussing it with a studio.
Got it.
But they didn't commission it, and they didn't end up buying it, as far as I could tell.
Okay.
If they did, I'd really love to know. But I mean, one of the things about Romero's archives is that he was very bad at keeping, like, the business side of things. He was interested in creative stuff. He was interested in the writing, so he would save everything that he wrote. But if you want to find, like, production information or, you know, like, even contracts, it's extremely hit and miss.
Yeah.
What he would actually hold on to.
What an artist, not a business guy, which I can respect that. It seems like while there wasn't a full screenplay written, there was, like, a really, really mapped out outline. Is this something that you were able to check out yourself?
Yeah. So this is, kind of how he worked, where he basically would write scripts and would insert, like, I don't know, when he was getting bored or impatient or whatever, would just like throw in a description of what's happening in the scene rather than writing it all out as like an official. Yes, formatted. But it is formatted mostly like a screenplay. It's like over 100 pages long. Like, it's the length of a screenplay.
Yeah.
It's just like at a few places, it just like says, well, in this scene, here's what happens. And then goes on to that. But it's like full of dialogue. And that's how, the thing is, like, that's how he wrote from the beginning. And that's what some of his screenplays look like shooting scripts early on. You know, he kind of professionalized up pretty quickly. But you read this stuff that he was writing like before Night of the Living Dead, even Night of the Living Dead. And it's just like, I don't know. You couldn't like buy script writing software.
Yeah. And
there was no like film production class at Carnegie Tech where he was going.
There really aren't any rules, and people that say they are kind of full of shit. So good for him.
I mean, you know, if you think about the purpose of a screenplay, it's so that everybody who's involved in the production knows what to do. And like, everybody involved in the production is your pal who you know really well, then like they'll, you know, just write something that they understand.
Yeah. And he's, you know, he's prolific. He's the artist. He's got to do what he's got to do.
Yeah.
And instead of going in the route that the 2015 Goosebumps movie made, where they sort of collect the whole universe of the books into one film, he took on the first film, or sort of the first book in the series, Welcome to Dead House.
Yeah.
Why do you think that is, that he sort of went the more traditional route rather than exploring all of the books?
Well, this is pure speculation, mind you, so keep that in mind. But there's a few things. One is, it's a zombie story.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if you're George Romero, he's had trouble getting movies made at several points in his career. And he's like, well, what if I make a zombie movie and he can get it made?
Smart.
You know, and so I have to think that there may be that sense to it.
Mm-hmm.
There's also the sense that, like, I don't think he's going to read all these books. I think he read one of them and was like, okay.
Yeah. And it was halfway through the original run, but yeah, you don't want to sit down and read 30 fucking books. So
Harold Stein was obscenely prolific. Just
wasn't like,
there's so many of those books.
It's got to have been ghostwriters, right? I'm convinced.
R.L. Stein isn't actually his name. It's the it's like the first and last letters of all the different writers' names, you know, mixed up.
It's just an acronym for all the writers locked in the basement. I got to interview him once, which was really cool. He also didn't seem like he was really all that obsessed with horror. He kind of made that clear. He was like,
interesting.
This kind of just happened to me and I'm old. And I was like, okay, I respect that. Yeah.
You know, I think that the other reason why is because that wasn't really, like, nobody had done that.
No.
That's pretty high concept and sort of.
It's a very modern.
It's not that, like, 2015 audiences are in any way more sophisticated than 1996 audiences.
God, no.
But just that, like, there was enough sort of prep for some kind of, like, a shared universe meta story.
Yeah, meta cinema was new at best at that time, right?
Yeah. You know, I mean, I don't think any of the characters would have been as well known. Like, the only reference point then would have been something like Space Jam, maybe? Is that around that time?
Yeah, same.
And, you know, even Slappy the Dummy is no Bugs Bunny in terms of, like,
I mean, isn't he? There are a lot of similarities between the two girls. There's a lot of similarities,
yeah, so, now that you mention it. But just in terms of, like, box office gold.
He wasn't really there yet. And, you know, do the first book also kind of make... Yeah, you're right. He's a zombie guy. Doing a zombie book kind of feels like a home run. Do the first book. If it's a success, maybe you do the second book, and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Have you read Welcome to Deadhouse?
I have. Okay. No, not in a hot minute, but I did read it, and I rewatched the, I think it's like a TV movie. It wasn't really an episode before talking to you today. I could be wrong. I really should have looked into this, but I believe they filmed Welcome to Deadhouse as sort of like a short TV film before the rest of the series. So the series were usually just like 20-minute episodes, but yeah, that was like an hour-long kind of event to sort of prep audiences. And they go into it hard, and it's pretty good. Have you seen it?
Yeah. It's a fun little thing. And there was some brief time when it was on some streaming service or other, and it was just like split into two episodes.
Yeah.
It definitely feels like the one that I just watched a few of them kind of in the background while I was working, you know, back whenever that was. And those were the ones that like really captured my attention. They were, you know, for kids and it's cheesy, but it's perfect, fun.
It's so camp too. Like all the like evil adults being like, "You're gonna love Dead Falls." I love it so much. And yeah, it's just like what my life looked like in 1996. It really is. Like all these weird pale adults in like suburban Toronto, just like, that's what 1996 looked like in Canada. So I love it.
That's wonderful to hear. I'm very happy to hear that. Yeah.
Yeah. So yes, I have read it. I've seen the episode recently. From my like vague research, it seems like he was pretty faithful to the book, but that there were some distinct changes. Would you say that's true?
Yeah, it's surprisingly faithful up to a point.
Okay.
So the setup, and I'll just like give the brief rundown of the story.
Yes, please.
I apologize that I'm not gonna like, like with a fine tooth comb, go through the differences between the two. I'm probably going to mistake the original novels at some point.
No one will know but you, right? So
yeah. But so it's about this family that moves to a tiny little town in the middle of nowhere. Is it called
Dark Falls?
Dark Falls, yeah, right. With a
don't move to Dark Falls. Just don't. Yeah. What are you doing?
With an ominous sign on the outside of town that reads 72 happy souls living yeah, here. Yeah, yeah. Population 72.
Not enough people.
It's from the point of view of the two kids, Josh and Amanda.
Oh yeah.
Who aren't thrilled about having to leave the city and all their friends, and move to this weird new town. But everybody's acting weird. They don't see anybody around at first. And like, it's just a lot that seems to be off about the town. Eventually, what they discover is that it's a town full of dead people.
Oh,
everybody's
shit.
Dead. They're all kind of zombie-ish things. And
yeah.
Original story basically has them defeating everybody with flashlights. You find out in the original story that just light kills them. And so they...
And sun and that.
In the sun. Yeah. Right. And then like, so they just get them into the sun and...
Pretty easy.
That reduces everybody. Yeah.
Yeah.
Everybody turns to bones and dust.
So...
Romero's, it's you know, you come to Dark Falls, things are off, everybody's dead, but it, like after that, everything gets like a bit more complicated.
Okay.
It turns out that everybody is dead because it is a former coal mining company town, and the owner of the coal mine is a black-hearted evil monster who is reaching out from beyond the grave to continue controlling a population of people, just like he did in life as the like boss of the coal company.
Oh my god, capitalism!
It's I love that George Romero was like, you know, I'm making a kids movie. It's really fun. There's a lot of like cool kid stuff in here. But they gotta worry about capitalism, though,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, that's very Romero. Good.
The evil industrialist. Yeah.
Yeah.
There's all sorts of stuff in the screenplay about like the townspeople, some of them feeling like very loyal to him for keeping them alive, or there's really like one sort of like representative, like a toady, who's the one who lures new victims into the town.
That Compton?
Yeah.
The spooky realtor?
The spooky real estate agent who lures more victims because the company owner needs to feed off a new family every year in order to maintain
do what you
his
have
power.
To do.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, I love that. So these are zombies. In the TV episode, they're kind of like wishy-washy if they're gonna like actually eat your flesh and your brains. Was that what he was going for with this movie?
They're not like that kind of zombies. They're okay. Just like everybody looks normal. You can't tell who's a zombie or not, and like the sort of middle act of the screenplay has to do with Josh, the little kid,
Josh Benson,
trying to figure out who is dead and who isn't, and then like eventually finds out like, oh, it's everybody, even my friend Karen, who I thought was
a hottie.
Was my pal who was helping me.
Yeah.
Turns out she's one of them.
God damn.
But also, like, it's so, you know, there are a lot of the Romero hallmarks in that, like, yes, capitalism. But also, it's got some like optimism to it. Like, it has a happy ending, and it turns out that like, well, a lot of the dead townspeople actually don't like being oppressed like this, and they, you know, fight back against Compton, Dawes, and the old company owner, and just sort of like, you know, help out the family. And it's, you know, there's some like optimism stuff in there that's unusual for a Romero project.
Cool, kind of cute. Yeah, I mean, you need someone to root for. When I was scrolling through it, there was this character called Uncle Spunky the Clown that I did not recognize. They got his head chopped off, so I thought that was pretty fucking weird.
There's some weird horror stuff in it. There is Uncle Spunky the Clown, which is just like a weird little detail, a weird little thing, that's stuck in there and that probably wouldn't have survived another draft.
I wonder.
But so, like I said, the zombies, they all look normal, but they can't get wet. Water.
Oh yes, it's water in the movie, not sun.
Yeah, water so, like, melts rain. Them, but it doesn't kill them.
It
just
them.
Like melts them, and
like
then.
Animals.
Yeah. Okay. Well, they like somebody like the little girl, Amanda, when Josh tries to convince her, she's like, what? Like Wizard of Oz? Help me, I'm melting.
Oh, yeah. Fair enough. Fair enough, Karen. Okay.
And like, so but it doesn't really kill them, I don't think. I feel, you know, like one more, this did need one more draft to be sort of tightened up. Like all the ideas are there, but like it's a little bit ambiguous.
Okay.
Like how much damage is caused by the rain, or if it's just like, well, I melt a little bit and then sort of have to grow back slowly. Or
I like
whatever.
That more than sun, though. It kind of ups the stakes because, you know, it doesn't rain as often as there's sun. It kind of gives them more space to roam around. I don't know.
I mean, if you go to a town, if you go any place and there's nobody, like zero people outside during the day, and then as soon as the sun goes down, everybody comes out, like
it's vampires.
Yeah, I mean, it's
or something. It's bad.
It's not good.
No.
It's not good.
Or the TV show, or maybe both. It's not a coal town, but it's like a chemical spill. It's like an environmental disaster.
Yeah, so I that comes from the book, where it's just like, well, this is a, I mean, it's a very sort of like 50s sci-fi explanation, you know, like, oh, there was a chemical cloud that did this to the residents.
No more explanation needed.
Yeah, right. Totally. But in this one, it's like fully supernatural, and it's all about like, you know, it's all about the greed of the industrialists, right?
Does it kind of give a little bit of a waft of the Crazies at all?
Yeah. Okay. I mean, that's from the book. That maybe that's why he wanted to shy away from it a little bit, because he kind of had done that already. Yeah,
like he'd done a lot of this already, but he'd never done it for kids.
He'd never done it for kids.
Could have done a good job of that.
I love the Crazies. I adore that movie. It's a movie that needs more attention, I feel like. You know, not just for like Romero enthusiasts, but like if you like horror movies, if you like movies, watch The Crazies. It's just like it's brilliant. Mm-hmm. It's weird, and you just like see faces in that movie of some, you know, Yinzers and other southwestern Pennsylvanians that just like those sorts of faces don't show up on screens in 2024. Just absolutely amazing.
What I love about movies from the 70s is they're just not afraid to cast an old ugly guy. You know, nowadays there's no old ugly guys on screens, but if you're gonna go watch like Salem's Lot from like whatever 1979, like it's packed of old ugly dudes, and I think that's cool.
Well, and they're all like faces that you're just like, my God, this face is so interesting.
Yeah,
like there's so many more responses you can have to faces other than like, well, that looks like a statue.
Yeah, I know. I know. I hope we evolve out of like the phase of all actors have to be models.
Yeah,
because there's something just not real about that.
Anytime like a Paul Giamatti or somebody breaks through, you're just like, I don't know, I'm riding for you, dude. Like, I'll go see anything you're in, no matter how bad it is. Like, I just it makes me happy to see you. If you show up, I'll stand up and cheer. You know,
in the water wasn't that bad. Okay, I liked it.
But also, like, the Crazies could not be any less interesting to Kit. So the opposite in sensibility. No kid would be interested in it. Yeah,
I actually think the remake is like real good.
I think about it. So I had a friend and I who were. We were both so excited because it was finally a horror movie that took advantage of a car wash as a location. Because there's that one scene, great idea.
Yeah.
The car is like going through the wash, and
it's scary.
It's something that, you know, I don't often have the call to go to a car wash, but my partner has a car, and I have taken it to the car wash a few times over the years, and every time that I do, I think about the Crazies remake.
Who wasn't scared going through a car wash as a kid too? I think it's actually a great idea for horror.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
we should see more of that. Are we missing any major plot points? I mean, it's not the world's most complicated story, the book, the TV show, or the Romero version. Is there anything that we're missing?
So the thing that struck me the most reading the screenplay is how much Romero is trying to he's not necessarily writing, like he's trying to adopt the tone of like a YA horror piece.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like the sort of film that, like, I don't know, Joe Dante might make.
Nice.
You know, that like is about kids and for kids, doesn't really condescend to them, but like has a
kind of scary, like kind of like The Gate or like
absolutely
the hole.
That came much later.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. But also, like, it tries to do things that kids think are funny and fun. Like, it feels like he's really making an effort to make a movie for kids.
Mm, cool.
And I don't know, like, I find that fascinating.
I think, and, like, he had kids. I think if I recall, like, in his letter to Fox, he talks about, like, having read some of these to his kid. And I think sometimes artists, actors, directors, they, like, kind of want to make something their kids can watch.
I think that's absolutely what he had in his head at this time. Yeah. You know, like,
it's not going to be Dawn of the Dead.
No, not gonna be Martin. Or, like I said, The Crazies. Like, yeah, not let's have that. A talky horror movie that's largely about the disaffection with American military policy.
Oh my god, I'm already asleep. Yeah. Yeah, kids can't. Kids are not good. But yeah, it'd be cool for him to make something for that broader audience.
Well, you know, one of the things that I was trying to do with this book is let people know that this, like, he made it, like, he wrote it. It didn't get made as a film, but, like, he did this work and it's great. And I really hope that it can, some of these scripts can get out there someday. Mm-hmm. Like, everything is obviously tied up in, you know, weird copyright stuff, but especially if it's a, you know, billion-dollar property like Goosebumps.
Yeah.
But, you know, it would be really nice if the work that, like, our great film artist did could get out there, even if it didn't result in a movie. You know, like, it's so revelatory reading these scripts and just seeing, like, you get to know George Romero, or at least you feel like you get to know him, get to know his sense of humor, what his interests are. And also, like, you know, the Goosebumps script is great. Like, it's better than the dark half of the movie, which is compromised. But, you know, yeah. Goosebumps never got,
never happened. It never got to that place. It's still pure.
Yeah, right. There was no, like, compromises that had to be made with, you know, like, terrible actors or, like, penny-pinching studios or, you know, some, like, executive interference or something like that. This is pure George Romero right here. And yeah,
I think would have been good in the lead role if it had ever happened. Omri Katz, the kid from Hocus Pocus.
Yeah, and he was in, wasn't he the kid who was in Eerie, Indiana?
Oh, hell yeah, he was.
So that was, see, okay. Now that is taking me back. Not a show I have thought about in a long time. But,
oh, it's so good.
That was like my favorite show.
Fuck yeah.
That was exactly the right time for me. I was exactly the right age.
Yeah, like 94 or something like that. Yeah.
And yeah. But it, like this, George's version of Welcome to Dead House, the Goosebumps script would have, like, it's longer than that, but, like, that's kind of the tone.
Okay.
Maybe a little less jokey and cartoony, but it's, you know, it's, like, in that area.
And, you know, like, kids like being scared. And you don't have to condescend them. And I was so appreciative when I was younger when movies or content, like, didn't treat me like a fucking idiot and would, like, go out and scare me. And I hope that, you know, they're still doing that.
Well, so do you get this question? Like, I get a question from people with kids who are like 8, 10, sometimes a little older. Mm-hmm. They just like want to know about horror movies. Mm-hmm. They want to know, and like the parents want to know, is this movie, does it have anything inappropriate? Is this something that I could show my 10-year-old?
Mm-hmm.
And like, I get a lot of that from people,
you know, so case by case basis, but I think a lot of kids in that age group now could probably handle a lot of what was out in the 80s.
Yeah, probably. It's, you know,
although it's, you're funny, gonna get because F word a lot, and I don't mean the word fuck.
No, the gender and sexual politics of those movies are rough. pretty
these,
bad.
These woke Gen X's or whatever, or Gen Z's, are not going to take well to that when they find out.
No. And then if you try to, you know, give them the like Carol Context. Clover argument about how, well, actually, there's this possibility for reading it a different way, and yes, oh there God. Are You're bad canceled. Things, but
you are canceled right now. I'm yeah. canceling you. Someone tweeted, and it was really funny because Sex and the City is going on Netflix in the States, I think, for the first time or whatever. And they were writing like, they're just not prepared for Gen Z to start watching that, and like the response to that, because they're gonna love it, but also like the terrible discourse that's going to happen now.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, I think like to wrap things up, how do you personally feel about Romero's vision of Goosebumps? Is this something that you would have liked to have seen?
Oh, hell yes. Mm. Yeah. I mean, this is, it's a great script. Like I said, it, you know, could use a little bit of tightening. There's some stuff that could be clarified. Yeah. This is just a first draft. You know, I would love it if people could read this or even like see it someday. That's never going to happen. Like no. $1 billion brand.
Second
at this
most
point.
Successful book series of all time. Number two. You know what number one is?
Right behind the Bible.
Harry Potter.
Yeah, no, I know.
Oh, I thought you were being serious. I know. The Bible's everywhere, you know? Like they still put them in hotel rooms.
Oh, it seems pretty successful to me. I don't know.
Yeah. Okay.
They so only wrote the one sequel fiction. Or maybe some more if you know the right people. I don't know.
But yeah, that shit's making money. They're still printing them. There was one fucking published in 2024 already, so...
Well, I love this script. I love mm-hmm. it so much. It's one of my favorites of the, you know, the unfilmed archive.
Yeah.
Romero's, yeah.
And I'm so glad that we got to have your insight, because you're one of the very few people on this planet that's been able to actually see it and read it and absorb it. So well, we're lucky so to have you here.
One thing that I should say is that, like... You do have to get to Pittsburgh. There are more expensive places to go to in the country, in the world. That's what I mean.
No one's going to Pittsburgh. Okay, yeah. Stop. Don't make try to make Pittsburgh happen.
So what I'm trying to say as I stumble over my own words is that the University of Pittsburgh lets anybody read this stuff. Like you have to make an appointment. You have to like arrange for like certain items to be made available and ready for you. Like anybody can read it. You don't need to be a student there or be like a fancy academic or mm-hmm. It doesn't cost any money. Like if you can get to Pittsburgh, you can go to the university library and read a script or two.
Yeah. But if you get to Pittsburgh, are you going to be able to leave? You know? You know, where they're gonna let you out.
It's a fantasy land. It's just so wonderful. It's a nice city. It's a nice city.
I've never
we like it.
Being an asshole. And you know, I've been wanting to do episodes about. We've done over 100 episodes of this podcast, and I've been wanting to do Romero since day one, and I've never ever done a Romero episode. And I always kind of thought, okay, one day I'll just do a miniseries, and we're just like super lucky to have one of like the premier Romero scholars with us. And so to end us off, I'm just wondering if you could just remind us a little bit about your book, what we can expect from it, and just remind us how we can get it.
Sure. So, you know, it's available anywhere that you can buy books online and should be in a lot of libraries. It's called Raising the Dead, the work of George A. Romero. And, you know, it is from a university press, but it's written so that anybody can pick it up. Like, you gotta kind of be interested in George Romero.
Well, yeah.
Who isn't? But I feel like I wrote it with the audience in mind of anybody, like the sort of person who would be listening to this podcast. Like, you don't have to have read any film theory or even know a ton about film history. It's about George Romero and really digs into a lot of stuff that people didn't No, he did. It talks about the famous, you know, zombie movies and Martin and deals with their development. And there's a lot of like analysis and such. But it also just sort of it's an attempt to give a like paint a picture of George Romero as an artist that takes into account like all this stuff that was important to him that he did that was brilliant and interesting and weird and funny and whatever, but just nobody in Hollywood or elsewhere wanted mm-hmm. to give him the money to actually put on film,
which is so disappointing. But you know, we got a lot from him, and at least we'll be able to dig into what could have happened here. So before we let you go, Adam, where can you be found online?
I guess I'm sort of on Twitter still, kind of.
Yeah.
I guess that's sort of my home base. It's my account is M_Hulot, like the Jacques Tati film. I am a film scholar.
I can tell.
I am a film nerd. I don't know. If you search Adam Charles Hart, George mm-hmm. Romero, or Adam Charles Hart, Raising the Dead, you will find my book, and you will find other places that I've written stuff and published stuff and that sort of thing.
Very cool. So you will be joining us again next week for our second episode of Romero Unseen. But thank you so much for chatting today. This was great.
Yeah, absolutely. This was a blast.
Thank you so much for listening to Development Hell. If you enjoy this podcast, then please do us a major favor of leaving us 5 stars and writing a positive review. It really makes all the difference in the world. We'll see you next week with a brand new episode of Development Hell.
Thank you for listening to the Dread Podcast Network.